This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Mary Poppins by P.L. Travers. This book is read by Sophie Thompson.
Chapter 1, East Wind. If you want to find Cherry Tree Lane, all you have to do is ask the policeman at the crossroads. He will push his helmet slightly to one side, scratch his head thoughtfully, and then he will point his huge white-gloved finger and say, "First you're right, second you're left, sharp right again, and you're there. Good morning." And sure enough, if you follow his directions exactly, you will be there, right in the middle of Cherry Tree Lane, where the houses run down one side and the park runs down the other, and the cherry trees go dancing right down the middle. If you are looking for number 17, and it is more than likely that you will be, for this book is all about that particular house, you will very soon find it. To begin with, it is the smallest house in the lane, and besides that, it is the only one that is rather dilapidated and needs a coat of paint. But Mr. Banks, who owns it, said to Mrs. Banks that she could have either a nice, clean, comfortable house, or four children, but not both, for he couldn't afford it. And after Mrs. Banks had given the matter some consideration, she came to the conclusion that she would rather have Jane, who was the eldest, and Michael, who came next, and John and Barbara, who were twins, and came last of all. So it was settled, and that was how the Banks family came to live at number 17, with Mrs. Brill to cook for them, and Ellen to lay the tables, and Roberts and I to cut the lawn and clean the knives and polish the shoes, and, as Mr. Banks always said, to waste his time and my money. And, of course, besides these, there was Katie Nanner, who doesn't really deserve to come into the book at all, because at the time I am speaking of, she had just left number 17. "Without by your leave or a word of warning, and what am I to do?" said Mrs. Banks.
"Advertise, my dear," said Mr. Banks, putting on his shoes. "And I wish Roberts and I would go without a word of warning, for he has again polished one boot and left the other untouched. I shall look very lopsided."
"That," said Mrs. Banks, "is not of the least importance. You haven't told me what I am to do about Katie Nanner."
"I don't see how you can do anything about her since she has disappeared," replied Mr. Banks. "But if it were me, I
should get somebody to put in the morning paper the news that Jane and Michael and John and Barbara Banks, to say nothing of their mother, require the best possible nanny at the lowest possible wage and at once. Then I should wait and watch for the nannies to queue up outside the front gate, and I should get very cross with them for holding up the traffic and making it necessary for me to give the policeman a shilling for putting him to so much trouble. Now I must be off. Whew! It's as cold as the North Pole. Which way is the wind blowing?"
And as he said that, Mr. Banks popped his head out of the window and looked down the lane to Admiral Boom's house at the corner. This was the grandest house in the lane, and the lane was very proud of it, because it was built exactly like a ship. There was a flagstaff in the garden, and on the roof was a gilt weathercock shaped like a telescope.
"Ha!" said Mr. Banks, drawing in his head very quickly. "Admiral's telescope says east wind. I thought as much. There is frost in my bones. I shall wear two overcoats."
And he kissed his wife absent-mindedly on one side of her nose, and waved to the children, and went away to the city. Now, the city was a place where Mr. Banks went every day, except Sundays, of course, and bank holidays. And while he was there, he sat on a large chair in front of a large desk and made money. All day long he worked, cutting out pennies and shillings and half-crowns and threepenny bits. And he brought them home with him in his little black bag. Sometimes he would give some to Jane and Michael for their money boxes, and when he couldn't spare any, he would say, "The bank is broken," and they would know he hadn't made much money that day. Well, Mr. Banks went off with his black bag, and Mrs. Banks went into the drawing-room and sat there all day long writing letters to the papers and begging them to send some nannies to her at once, as she was waiting. And upstairs in the nursery, Jane and Michael watched at the window and wondered who would come. They were glad Katie Nanner had gone, for they had never liked her. She was old and fat and smelt of barley water. Anything they thought would be better than Katie Nanner, if not much better. When the afternoon began to die away behind the park, Mrs. Brillinellen came to give them their supper and to bath the twins. And after supper, Jane and Michael sat at the window watching for Mr. Banks to come home and listening to the sound of the east wind blowing through the naked branches of the cherry trees in the lane. The trees themselves, turning and bending in the half-light, looked as though they had gone mad and were dancing their roots out of the ground. "There he is," said Michael, pointing suddenly to a shape that banged heavily against the gate. Jane peered through the gathering darkness. "That's not Daddy," she said. "It's somebody else." Then the shape tossed and bent under the wind, lifted the latch of the gate, and they could see that it belonged to a woman who was holding her hat on with one hand and carrying a bag in the other. As they watched, Jane and Michael saw a curious thing happen. As soon as the shape was inside the gate, the wind seemed to catch her up into the air and fling her at the house. It was as though it had flung her first at the gate, waited for her to open it, and then lifted and thrown her, bag and all, at the front door. The watching children heard a terrific bang, and as she landed, the whole house shook. "How funny! I've never seen that happen before," said Michael. "Let's go and see who it is," said Jane, and taking Michael's arm, she drew him away from the window, through the nursery, and out onto the landing. From there, they always had a good view of anything that happened in the front hall. Presently, they saw their mother coming out of the drawing room with a visitor following her. Jane and Michael could see that the newcomer had shiny black hair. "Rather like a wooden Dutch doll," whispered Jane, and that she was thin, with large feet and hands, and small, rather peering blue eyes. "You'll find that they are very nice children," Mrs. Banks was saying. Michael's elbow gave a sharp dig at Jane's ribs. "And that they give no trouble at all," continued Mrs. Banks uncertainly, as if she herself didn't really believe what she was saying. They heard the visitor sniff as though she didn't either. "Now, about references," Mrs. Banks went on. "Oh, I make it a rule never to give references," said the other firmly. Mrs. Banks stared. "But I thought it was usual," she said. "I mean, I understood people always did." "A very old-fashioned idea to my mind," Jane and Michael heard the stern voice say. "Very old-fashioned, quite out of date, as you might say." Now, if there was one thing Mrs. Banks did not like, it was to be thought old-fashioned. She just couldn't bear it, so she said quickly, "Very well, then. We won't bother about them. I only asked, of course, in case you, required it. The nursery is upstairs." And she led the way towards the staircase, talking all the time without stopping once. And because she was doing that, Mrs. Banks did not notice what was happening behind her. But Jane and Michael, watching from the top landing, had an excellent view of the extraordinary thing the visitor now did. Certainly she followed Mrs. Banks upstairs, but not in the usual way. With her large bag in her hands, she slid gracefully up the banisters and arrived at the landing at the same time as Mrs. Banks. Such a thing, Jane and Michael knew, had never been done before. Down, of course, for they had often done it themselves, but up, never. They gazed curiously at the strange new visitor. "Well, that's all settled, then." A sigh of relief came from the children's mother. "Quite. As long as I'm satisfied," said the other, wiping her nose with a large red-and-white bandana handkerchief. "Why, children," said Mrs. Banks, noticing them suddenly, "what are you doing there? This is your new nurse, Mary Poppins. Jane, Michael, say how do you do, and these," she waved her hand at the babies in their cots, "are the twins." Mary Poppins regarded them steadily, looking from one to the other, as though she were making up her mind whether she liked them or not. "Will we do?" said Michael. "Michael, don't be naughty," said his mother. Mary Poppins continued to regard the four children searchingly. Then, with a long, loud sniff that seemed to indicate that she had made up her mind, she said, "I'll take the position." For all the world, as Mrs. Banks said to her husband later, as though she were doing us a signal honour. "Perhaps she is," said Mr. Banks, putting his nose round the corner of the newspaper for a moment, and then withdrawing it very quickly. When their mother had gone, Jane and Michael edged towards Mary Poppins, who stood, still as a post, with her hands folded in front of her. "How did you come?" Jane asked. "It looked just as if the wind blew you here." "It did," said Mary Poppins briefly, and she proceeded to unwind her muffler from her neck and to take off her hat, which she hung on one of the bedposts. As it did not seem as though Mary Poppins were going to say any more, though she sniffed a great deal, Jane, too, remained silent. But when she bent down to undo her bag, Michael could not restrain himself. "What a funny bag," he said, pinching it with his fingers. "Carpet," said Mary Poppins, putting her key in the lock. "To carry carpets in, you mean?" "No, made of." "Oh," said Michael, "I see." But he didn't, quite. By this time the bag was open, and Jane and Michael were more than surprised to find it was completely empty. "Why," said Jane, "there's nothing in it." "What do you mean, nothing?" demanded Mary Poppins, drawing herself up and looking as though she had been insulted. "Nothing in it, did you say?" And with that she took out from the empty bag a starched white apron and tied it around her waist. Next she unpacked a large cake of sunlight soap, a toothbrush, a packet of hairpins, a bottle of scent, a small folding armchair, and a box of throat lozenges. Jane and Michael stared. "But I saw," whispered Michael. "I'm sure it was empty." "Hush," said Jane, as Mary Poppins took out a large bottle labelled 1 teaspoon to be taken at bedtime. A spoon was attached to the neck of the bottle, and into this Mary Poppins poured a dark crimson fluid. "Is that your medicine?" inquired Michael, looking very interested. "No, yours," said Mary Poppins, holding out the spoon to him. Michael stared. He wrinkled up his nose. He began to protest. "I don't want it. I don't need it. I won't." But Mary Poppins's eyes were fixed upon him, and Michael suddenly discovered that you could not look at Mary Poppins and disobey her. There was something strange and extraordinary about her. Something that was frightening and at the same time most exciting. The spoon came nearer. He held his breath, shut his eyes and gulped. A delicious taste ran round his mouth. He turned his tongue in it, he swallowed, and a happy smile ran round his face. "Strawberry ice," he said ecstatically. "More, more, more." But Mary Poppins, her face as stern as before, was pouring out a dose for Jane. It ran into the spoon, silvery, greeny, yellowy. Jane tasted it. "Lime juice cordial," she said, sliding her tongue deliciously over her lips. But when she saw Mary Poppins moving towards the twins with the bottle, Jane rushed at her. "Oh, no, please, they're too young. It wouldn't be good for them, please." Mary Poppins, however, took no notice, but with a warning, terrible glance at Jane, tipped the spoon towards John's mouth. He lapped at it eagerly, and by the few drops that were spilt on his bib, Jane and Michael could tell that the substance in the spoon this time was milk. Then Barbara had her share, and she gurgled and licked the spoon twice. Mary Poppins then poured out another dose, and solemnly took it herself. "Rum punch," she said, smacking her lips and corking the bottle. Jane's eyes and Michael's popped with astonishment. But they were not given much time to wonder, for Mary Poppins, having put the miraculous bottle on the mantelpiece, turned to them. "Now," she said, "Spit Spot into bed." And she began to undress them. They noticed that whereas Buttons and Hooks had needed all sorts of coaxing from Katie Nana, for Mary Poppins they flew apart almost at a look. In less than a minute they found themselves in bed and watching, by the dim light from the nightlight, the rest of Mary Poppins' unpacking being performed. From the carpet bag she took out 7 flannel nightgowns, 4 cotton ones, a pair of boots, a set of dominoes, 2 bathing caps and a postcard album. Last of all came a folding camp bedstead with blankets and eiderdown complete, and this she set down between John's cot and Barbara's. Jane and Michael sat hugging themselves and watching. It was all so surprising that they could find nothing to say, but they knew, both of them, that something strange and wonderful had happened at No. 17 Cherry Tree Lane. Mary Poppins, slipping one of the flannel nightgowns over her head, began to undress underneath it as though it were a tent. Michael, charmed by this strange new arrival, unable to keep silent any longer, called to her. "Mary Poppins," he cried, "you'll never leave us, will you?" There was no reply from under the nightgown. Michael could not bear it. "You won't leave us, will you?" he called anxiously. Mary Poppins's head came out of the top of the nightgown. She looked very fierce. "One word more from that direction," she said threateningly, "and I'll call the policeman." "I was only saying," began Michael meekly, "that we hoped you wouldn't be going away soon." He stopped, feeling very red and confused. Mary Poppins stared from him to Jane in silence, then she sniffed. "I'll stay till the wind changes," she said shortly, and she blew out her candle and got into bed. "That's all right," said Michael, half to himself and half to Jane. But Jane wasn't listening. She was thinking about all that had happened, and wondering. And that is how Mary Poppins came to live at number 17 Cherry Tree Lane. And although they sometimes found themselves wishing for the quieter, more ordinary days when Katie Nana ruled the household, everybody, on the whole, was glad of Mary Poppins's arrival. Mr. Banks was glad because as she arrived by herself and did not hold up the traffic, he had not had to tip the policeman. Mrs. Banks was glad because she was able to tell everybody that her children's nurse was so fashionable that she didn't believe in giving references. Mrs. Brill and Ellen were glad because they could drink strong cups of tea all day in the kitchen and no longer needed to preside at nursery suppers. Roberts and I was glad, too, because Mary Poppins had only one pair of shoes, and those she polished herself. Nobody ever knew what Mary Poppins felt about it. For Mary Poppins never told anybody anything. Chapter 2. The Day Out. "Every third Thursday," said Mrs. Banks, "two till five." Mary Poppins eyed her sternly. "The best people, ma'am," she said, "give every second Thursday and one till six, and those I shall take, or—" Mary Poppins paused, and Mrs. Banks knew what the pause meant. It meant that if she didn't get what she wanted, Mary Poppins would not stay. "Very well, very well," said Mrs. Banks hurriedly, though she wished Mary Poppins did not know so very much more about the best people than she did herself. So Mary Poppins put on her white gloves and tucked her umbrella under her arm, not because it was raining, but because it had such a beautiful handle that she couldn't possibly leave it at home. How could you leave your umbrella behind if it had a parrot's head for a handle? Besides, Mary Poppins was very vain and liked to look her best. Indeed, she was quite sure that she never looked anything else. Jane waved to her from the nursery window. "Where are you going?" she called. "Kindly close that window," replied Mary Poppins, and Jane's head hurriedly disappeared inside the nursery. Mary Poppins walked down the garden path and opened the gate. Once outside in the lane, she set off walking very quickly, as if she were afraid the afternoon would run away from her if she didn't keep up with it. At the corner, she turned to the right and then to the left, nodded haughtily to the policeman, who said it was a nice day, and by that time she felt that her day out had begun. She stopped beside an empty motor car in order to put her hat straight with the help of the windscreen in which it was reflected. Then she smoothed down her frock and tucked her umbrella more securely under her arm so that the handle, or rather the parrot, could be seen by everybody. After these preparations, she went forward to meet the matchman. Now, the matchman had two professions. He not only sold matches, like any ordinary matchman, but he drew pavement pictures as well. He did these things turnabout according to the weather. If it was wet, he sold matches, because the rain would have washed away his pictures if he had painted them. If it was fine, he was on his knees all day, making pictures in coloured chalks on the sidewalks, and doing them so quickly that often you would find he had painted up one side of a street and down the other almost before you'd had time to come round the corner. On this particular day, which was fine but cold, he was painting. He was in the act of adding a picture of two bananas, an apple, and a head of Queen Elizabeth to a long string of others when Mary Poppins walked up to him, tiptoeing so as to surprise him. "Hey," called Mary Poppins softly. He went on putting brown stripes on a banana and brown curls on Queen Elizabeth's head. "Ahem," said Mary Poppins with a ladylike cough. He turned with a start and saw her. "Mary," he cried, and you could tell by the way he cried it that Mary Poppins was a very important person in his life. Mary Poppins looked down at her feet and rubbed the toe of one shoe along the pavement 2 or 3 times. Then she smiled at the shoe in such a way that the shoe knew quite well that the smile wasn't meant for it. "It's my day, Bert," she said. "Didn't you remember?" Bert was the matchman's name, Herbert Alfred for Sundays. "Of course I remembered Mary," he said. "But..." And he stopped and looked sadly into his cap. It lay on the ground beside his last pitcher, and there was tuppence in it. He picked it up and jingled the pennies. "That all you got, Bert?" said Mary Poppins, and she said it so brightly you could hardly tell she was disappointed at all. "That's the lot," he said. "Business is bad today. You'd think anybody would be glad to pay to see that, wouldn't you?" And he nodded his head at Queen Elizabeth. "Well, that's how it is, Mary," he sighed. "Can't take you to tea today, I'm afraid." Mary Poppins thought of the raspberry jam cakes they always had on her day out, and she was just going to sigh when she saw the matchman's face. So, very cleverly, she turned the sigh into a smile, a good one, with both ends turned up, and said, "That's all right, Bert. Don't you mind. I'd much rather not go to tea. A stodgy meal, I call it, really." And that, when you think how very much she liked raspberry jam cakes, was rather nice of Mary Poppins. The matchman apparently thought so too, for he took her white-gloved hand in his and squeezed it hard. Then together they walked down the row of pitchers. "Now there's one you've never seen before," said the matchman proudly, pointing to a painting of a mountain covered with snow and its slopes simply littered with grasshoppers sitting on gigantic roses. This time Mary Poppins could indulge in a sigh without hurting his feelings. "Oh, Bert," she said, "that's a fair treat." And by the way she said it, she made him feel that by rights the picture should have been in the Royal Academy, which is a large room where people hang the pictures they have painted. Everybody comes to see them, and when they have looked at them for a very long time, everybody says to everybody else, "The idea! My dear!" The next picture Mary Poppins and the matchman came to was even better. It was the country, all trees and grass, and a little bit of blue sea in the distance, and something that looked like Margate in the background. "My word," said Mary Poppins admiringly, stooping so that she could see it better. "Why, Bert, whatever is the matter?" For the matchman had caught hold of her other hand now and was looking very excited. "Mary," he said, "I've got an idea, a real idea. Why don't we go there right now, this very day, both together into the picture, eh, Mary?" And still holding her hands, he drew her right out of the street, away from the iron railings and the lampposts, into the very middle of the picture. Pfft! There they were, right inside it. How green it was there, how quiet, and what soft, crisp grass under their feet. They could hardly believe it was true, and yet here were green branches huskily rattling on their hats as they bent beneath them, and little coloured flowers curling round their shoes. They stared at each other, and each noticed that the other had changed. To Mary Poppins, the matchman seemed to have bought himself an entirely new suit of clothes, for he was now wearing a bright green and red striped coat, and white flannel trousers, and best of all, a new straw hat. He looked unusually clean, as though he had been polished. "Why, Bert, you look fine," she cried in an admiring voice. Bert could not say anything for a moment, for his mouth had fallen open, and he was staring at her with round eyes. Then he gulped and said, "Golly." That was all, but he said it in such a way and stared so steadily and so delightedly at her that she took a little mirror out of her bag and looked at herself in it. She, too, she discovered, had changed. Round her shoulders hung a cloak of lovely artificial silk with watery patterns all over it, and the tickling feeling at the back of her neck came, the mirror told her, from a long curly feather that swept down from the brim of her hat. Her best shoes had disappeared, and in their place were others, much finer, and with large diamond buckles shining upon them. She was still wearing the white gloves and carrying the umbrella. "My goodness," said Mary Poppins, "I am having a day out." So, still admiring themselves and each other, they moved on together through the little wood, till presently they came upon a little open space filled with sunlight. And there, on a green table, was afternoon tea. A pile of raspberry jam cakes as high as Mary Poppins's waist stood in the centre, and beside it, tea was boiling in a big brass urn. Best of all, there were two plates of whelks and two pins to pick them out with. "Strike me pink," said Mary Poppins. That was what she always said when she was pleased. "Golly," said the matchman, and that was his particular phrase. "Won't you sit down, madam?" inquired a voice, and they turned to find a tall man in a black coat coming out of the wood with a table napkin over his arm. Mary Poppins, thoroughly surprised, sat down with a plop upon one of the little green chairs that stood round the table. The matchman, staring, collapsed onto another. "I'm the waiter, you know," explained the man in the black coat. "Oh, but I didn't see you in the picture," said Mary Poppins. "Ah, I was behind the tree," explained the waiter. "Won't you sit down?" said Mary Poppins politely. "Waiters never sit down, madam," said the man, but he seemed pleased at being asked. "Your whelks, mister," he said, pushing a plate of them over to the matchman, "and your pin." He dusted the pin on his napkin and handed it to the matchman. They began upon the afternoon tea, and the waiter stood beside them to see they had everything they needed. "We're having them after all," said Mary Poppins in a loud whisper as she began on the heap of raspberry jam cakes. "Golly," agreed the matchman, helping himself to two of the largest. "Tea?" said the waiter, filling a large cup for each of them from the urn. They drank it and had two more cups each, and then, for luck, they finished the pile of raspberry jam cakes. After that, they got up and brushed the crumbs off. "There is nothing to pay," said the waiter, before they had time to ask for the bill. "It is a pleasure. You will find the merry-go-round just over there." And he waved his hand to a little gap in the trees, where Mary Poppins and the matchman could see several wooden horses whirling round on a stand. "That's funny," said she. "I don't remember seeing that in the picture, either." "Ah," said the matchman, who hadn't remembered it himself. "It was in the background, you see." The merry-go-round was just slowing down as they approached it. They leapt upon it, Mary Poppins on a black horse and the matchman on a grey. And when the music started again and they began to move, they rode all the way to Yarmouth and back, because that was the place they both wanted most to see. When they returned, it was nearly dark, and the waiter was watching for them. "I'm very sorry, madam and mister," he said politely, "but we close at 7. Rules, you know. May I show you the way out?" They nodded as he flourished his table napkin and walked on in front of them through the wood. "It's a wonderful picture you've drawn this time, Bert," said Mary Poppins, putting her hand through the matchman's arm and drawing her cloak about her. "Well, I did my best, Mary," said the matchman modestly, but you could see he was really very pleased with himself indeed. Just then the waiter stopped in front of them beside a large white doorway that looked as though it were made of thick chalk lines. "Here you are," he said. "This is the way out." "Goodbye, and thank you," said Mary Poppins, shaking his hand. "Madam, goodbye," said the waiter, bowing so low that his head knocked against his knees. He nodded to the matchman, who cocked his head on one side and closed one eye at the waiter, which was his way of bidding him farewell. Then Mary Poppins stepped through the white doorway, and the matchman followed her. And as they went, the feather dropped from her hat, and the silk cloak from her shoulders, and the diamonds from her shoes. The bright clothes of the matchman faded, and his straw hat turned into his old ragged cap again. Mary Poppins turned and looked at him, and she knew at once what had happened. Standing on the pavement, she gazed at him for a long minute, and then her glance explored the wood behind him for the waiter. But the waiter was nowhere to be seen. There was nobody in the picture. Nothing moved there. Even the merry-go-round had disappeared. Only the still trees and the grass and the unmoving little patch of sea remained. But Mary Poppins and the matchman smiled at one another. They knew, you see, what lay behind the trees. When she came back from her day out, Jane and Michael came running to meet her. "Where have you been?" they asked her. "In Fairyland," said Mary Poppins.
Did you see Cinderella? Said Jane.
Ha! Cinderella, not me, said Mary Poppins contemptuously. Cinderella, indeed.
Or Robinson Crusoe? Asked Michael.
Robinson Crusoe, pooh, said Mary Poppins rudely.
Then how could you have been there? It couldn't have been our fairyland.
Mary Poppins gave a superior sniff.
Don't you know, she said pityingly, that everybody's got a fairyland of their own?
And with another sniff, she went upstairs to take off her white gloves and put the umbrella away.
Chapter 3. Laughing Gas. Are you quite sure he will be at home? Said Jane as they got off the bus. She and Michael and Mary Poppins.
Would my uncle ask me to bring you to tea if he intended to go out, I'd like to know, said Mary Poppins, who was evidently very offended by the question. She was wearing her blue coat with the silver buttons and the blue hat to match, and on the days when she wore these, it was the easiest thing in the world to offend her. All three of them were on the way to pay a visit to Mary Poppins's uncle, Mr. Wig, and Jane and Michael had looked forward to the trip for so long that they were more than half afraid that Mr. Wig might not be in after all.
"Why is he called Mr. Wig? Does he wear one?" asked Michael, hurrying along beside Mary Poppins.
"He is called Mr. Wig because Mr. Wig is his name, and he doesn't wear one. He is bald," said Mary Poppins, "and if I have any more questions, we will just go back home." And she sniffed her usual sniff of displeasure.
Jane and Michael looked at each other and frowned, and the frown meant, "Don't let's ask her anything else or we'll never get there."
Mary Poppins put her hat straight at the tobacconist shop at the corner. It had one of those curious windows where there seemed to be three of you instead of one, so that if you look long enough at them, you begin to feel you are not yourself, but a whole crowd of somebody else. Mary Poppins sighed with pleasure, however, when she saw three of herself, each wearing a blue coat with silver buttons and a blue hat to match. She thought it was such a lovely sight that she wished there had been a dozen of her, or even 30. The more Mary Poppinses, the better.
Come along, she said sternly, as though they had kept her waiting. Then they turned the corner and pulled the bell of number 3 Robertson Road. Jane and Michael could hear it faintly echoing from a long way away, and they knew that in 1 minute, or two at the most, they would be having tea with Mary Poppins's uncle, Mr. Wig, for the first time ever. "If he's in, of course," Jane said to Michael in a whisper. At that moment, the door flew open, and a thin, watery-looking lady appeared.
"Is he in?" said Michael quickly.
"I'll thank you," said Mary Poppins, giving him a terrible glance, "to let me do the talking."
"How do you do, Mrs. Wig?" said Jane politely.
"Mrs. Wig," said the thin lady in a voice even thinner than herself, "how dare you call me Mrs. Wig? No, thank you. I'm plain Miss Persimmon, and proud of it, Mrs. Wig indeed."
She seemed to be quite upset, and they thought Mr. Wig must be a very odd person if Miss Persimmon was so glad not to be Mrs. Wig.
"Straight up and first door on the landing," said Miss Persimmon,
and she went hurrying away down the passage, saying, "Mrs. Wig, indeed," to herself in a high, thin, outraged voice. Jane and Michael followed Mary Poppins upstairs. Mary Poppins knocked at the door.
Come in, and welcome," called a loud, cheery voice from inside.
Jane's heart was pitter-pattering with excitement. "He is in," she signalled to Michael with a look. Mary Poppins opened the door and pushed them in front of her. A large, cheerful room lay before them. At one end of it, a fire was burning brightly, and in the centre stood an enormous table laid for tea. 4 cups and saucers, piles of bread and butter, crumpets, coconut cakes, and a large plum cake with pink icing.
"Well, this is indeed a pleasure!"
A huge voice greeted them, and Jane and Michael looked around for its owner. He was nowhere to be seen. The room appeared to be quite empty. Then they heard Mary Poppins saying crossly,
"Oh, Uncle Albert, not again! It's not your birthday, is it?"
And as she spoke, she looked up at the ceiling. Jane and Michael looked up too, and to their surprise saw a round, fat, bald man who was hanging in the air without holding on to anything. Indeed, he appeared to be sitting on the air, for his legs were crossed, and he had just put down the newspaper which he had been reading when they came in.
"My dear," said Mr. Wig, smiling down at the children and looking apologetically at Mary Poppins, "I'm very sorry, but I'm afraid it is my birthday." said Mary Poppins. "I only remembered last night, and there was no time then to send you a postcard asking you to come another day. Very distressing, isn't it?" he said, looking down at Jane and Michael. "I can see you're rather surprised," said Mr. Wig, and indeed, their mouths were so wide open with astonishment that Mr. Wig, if he had been a little smaller, might almost have fallen into one of them. "I've better explain, I think," Mr. Wig went on calmly. "You see, it's this way. I'm a cheerful sort of man and very disposed to laughter. You wouldn't believe, either of you, the number of things that strike me as being funny. I can laugh at pretty nearly everything I can." And with that, Mr. Wig began to bob up and down, shaking with laughter at the thought of his own cheerfulness. "Uncle Albert," said Mary Poppins, and Mr. Wig stopped laughing with a jerk. "Oh, beg pardon, my dear. Where was I? Oh, yes, well, the funny thing about me is... All right, Mary, I won't laugh if I can help it. But whenever my birthday falls on a Friday, well, it's all up with me. Absolutely U.P.," said Mr. Wig. "But why?" began Jane. "But how?" began Michael. "Well, you see, if I laugh on that particular day, I become so filled with laughing gas that I simply can't keep on the ground. Even if I smile, it happens. The first funny thought, and I'm up like a balloon. And until I can think of something serious, I can't get down again." Mr. Wig began to chuckle at that, but he caught sight of Mary Poppins's face and stopped the chuckle and continued. "It's awkward, of course, but not unpleasant. Never happens to either of you, I suppose." Jane and Michael shook their heads. "No, I thought not. It seems to be my own special habit. Once, after I'd been to the circus the night before, I laughed so much that, would you believe it? I was up here for a whole 12 hours. I couldn't get down to the last stroke of midnight. Then, of course, I came down with a flop because it was Saturday and not my birthday anymore. It's rather odd, isn't it, not to say funny? And now here it is Friday again and my birthday and you two and Mary P. to visit me. Oh, lordy, lordy, don't make me laugh, I beg of you." But although Jane and Michael had done nothing very amusing except to stare at him in astonishment, Mr. Wig began to laugh again loudly, and as he laughed he went bouncing and bobbing about in the air with a newspaper rattling in his hand and his spectacles half on and half off his nose. He looked so comic, floundering in the air like a great human bubble, clutching at the ceiling sometimes and sometimes at the gas bracket as he passed it, that Jane and Michael, though they were trying hard to be polite, just couldn't help doing what they did. They laughed, and they laughed. They shut their mouths tight to prevent the laughter escaping, but that didn't do any good. And presently they were rolling over and over on the floor, squealing and shrieking with laughter. "Really," said Mary Poppins, "really such behaviour." "I can't help it, I can't help it," shrieked Michael as he rolled into the fender. "It's so terribly funny. Oh, Jane, isn't it funny?" Jane did not reply, for a curious thing was happening to her. As she laughed, she felt herself growing lighter and lighter, just as though she were being pumped full of air. It was a curious and delicious feeling, and it made her want to laugh all the more. And then suddenly, with a bouncing bound, she felt herself jumping through the air. Michael, to his astonishment, saw her go soaring up through the room. With a little bump, her head touched the ceiling, and then she went bouncing along it till she reached Mr. Wig. "Well," said Mr. Wig, looking very surprised indeed, "don't tell me it's your birthday too." Jane shook her head. "It's not. Then this laughing gas must be catching. Hi, whoa there, look out for the mantelpiece." This was to Michael, who had suddenly risen from the floor and was swooping through the air, roaring with laughter and just grazing the china ornaments on the mantelpiece as he passed. He landed with a bounce right on Mr. Wig's knee. "How do you do?" said Mr. Wig, heartily shaking Michael by the hand. "I call this really friendly of you, bless my soul, I do, to come up to me since I couldn't come down to you, eh?" And then he and Michael looked at each other and flung back their heads and simply howled with laughter. "I say," said Mr. Wig to Jane as he wiped his eyes, "you'll be thinking I have the worst manners in the world. You're standing and you ought to be sitting. A nice young lady like you. I'm afraid I can't offer you a chair up here, but I think you'll find the air quite comfortable to sit on. I do."
Jane tried it and found she could sit down quite comfortably on the air. She took off her hat and laid it down beside her, and it hung there in space without any support at all.
"That's right," said Mr. Wig. Then he turned and looked down at Mary Poppins. "Well, Mary, we're fixed, and now I can inquire about you, my dear. I must say I am very glad to welcome you and my two young friends here today. Why, Mary, you're frowning. I'm afraid you don't approve of, all of this."
He waved his hand at Jane and Michael and said hurriedly,
"I apologise, Mary, my dear, but you know how it is with me. Still, I must say, I never thought my two young friends here would catch it. Really, I didn't, Mary. I suppose I should have asked them for another day, or tried to think of something sad, or something..."
"Well, I must say," said Mary Poppins primly, "that I have never in my life seen such a sight, and at your age, Uncle..."
"Mary Poppins, Mary Poppins, do come up," interrupted Michael. "Think of something funny, and you'll find it's quite easy."
"Ah, now do, Mary," said Mr. Wig persuasively.
"We're lonely up here without you," said Jane, and held out her arms towards Mary Poppins. "Do think of something funny."
"Ah, she doesn't need to," said Mr. Wig, sighing. "She can come up if she wants to, even without laughing, and she knows it."
And he looked mysteriously and secretly at Mary Poppins as she stood down there on the hearthrug.
"Well," said Mary Poppins, "it's all very silly and undignified, but since you're all up there and don't seem able to get down, I suppose I'd better come up too."
With that, to the surprise of Jane and Michael, she put her hands down at her sides, and without a laugh, without even the faintest glimmer of a smile, she shot up through the air and sat down beside Jane.
"How many times, I should like to know," she said snappily, "have I told you to take off your coat when you come into a hot room?"
And she unbuttoned Jane's coat and laid it neatly on the air beside the hat.
"That's right, Mary, that's right," said Mr. Wig contentedly as he leant down and put his spectacles on the mantelpiece. "Now we're all comfortable."
"There's comfort and comfort," sniffed Mary Poppins.
"And we can have tea," Mr. Wig went on, apparently not noticing her remark.
And then a startled look came over his face.
"My goodness," he said, "how dreadful. I've just realised. The table's down there, and we're up here. What are we going to do? We're here, and it's there. Oh, it's an awful tragedy, awful. But, oh, it's terribly comic."
And he hid his face in his handkerchief and laughed loudly into it.
Jane and Michael, though they did not want to miss the crumpets and the cakes, couldn't help laughing too, because Mr. Wig's mirth was so infectious. Mr. Wig dried his eyes.
"There's only one thing for it," he said. "We must think of something serious. Something sad, very sad. And then we shall be able to get down. Now, one, two, three.
Something very sad, mind you."
They thought and thought with their chins on their hands. Michael thought of school and that one day he would have to go there. But even that seemed funny today, and he had to laugh. Jane thought, "I shall be grown up in another 14 years. But that didn't sound sad at all, but quite nice and rather funny. She could not help smiling at the thought of herself grown up with long skirts and a handbag.
"There was my poor old Aunt Emily," thought Mr. Wig out loud. "She was run over by an omnibus. Sad, very sad, unbearably sad. Poor Aunt Emily. But they saved her umbrella. That was funny, wasn't it?" And before he knew where he was heaving and trembling and bursting with laughter at the thought of Aunt Emily's umbrella.
"It's no good," he said, blowing his nose. "I give up. And my young friends here seem to be no better at sadness than I am.
Mary, can't you do something? We want our tea."
To this day, Jane and Michael cannot be sure of what happened then. All they know for certain is that, as soon as Mr. Wig had appealed to Mary Poppins, the table below began to wriggle on its legs.
Presently it was swaying dangerously, and then with a rattle of china and with cakes lurching off their plates onto the cloth, the table came soaring through the room, gave one graceful turn, and landed beside them so that Mr. Wig was at its head.
"Good girl," said Mr. Wig, smiling proudly upon her. "I knew you'd fix something. Now, will you take the foot of the table and pour out, Mary? And the guests on either side of me, that's the idea," he said, as Michael ran, bobbing through the air, and sat down on Mr. Wig's right. Jane was at his left hand. There they were, all together, up in the air, and the table between them. Not a single piece of bread and butter or a lump of sugar had been left behind. Mr. Wig smiled contentedly. "It is usual, I think, to begin with bread and butter," he said to Jane and Michael. "But as it's my birthday, we will begin the wrong way, which I always think is the right way, with the cake." And he cut a large slice for everybody. "More tea?" he said to Jane. But before she had time to reply, there was a quick, sharp knock at the door. "Come in," called Mr. Wig. The door opened, and there stood Miss Persimmon with a jug of hot water on a tray. "I thought, Mr. Wig," she began, looking searchingly round the room, "you'd be wanting some more hot—" "Well, I never. I simply never," she said as she caught sight of them all seated on the air round the table. "Such goings on I never did see. In all my born days I never saw such. I'm sure, Mr. Wig, I always knew you were a bit odd, but I've closed my eyes to it, being as how you paid your rent regular. But such behaviour as this, having tea in the air with your guests, Mr. Wig, sir, I'm astonished at you. It's that undignified, and for a gentleman of your age, I never did."
"But perhaps you will, Miss Persimmon," said Michael.
"Will what?" said Miss Persimmon haughtily. "Catch the laughing gas as we did," said Michael. Miss Persimmon flung back her head scornfully. "I hope, young man," she retorted, "I have more respect for myself than to go bouncing about in the air like a rubber ball on the end of a bat. I'll stay on my own feet, thank you, or my name's not Amy Persimmon, and—" oh, dear, my goodness, oh, dear, what is the matter? I can't walk, I'm going— oh, help, help!"
For Miss Persimmon, quite against her will, was off the ground and was stumbling through the air, rolling from side to side like a very thin barrel, balancing the tray in her hand. She was almost weeping with distress as she arrived at the table and put down her jug of hot water.
"Thank you," said Mary Poppins in a calm, very polite voice.
Then Miss Persimmon turned and went wafting down again, murmuring as she went, "So undignified, and me a well-behaved, steady-going woman. Oh, I must see a doctor." When she touched the floor, she ran hurriedly out of the room, wringing her hands and not giving a single glance backwards. "So undignified," they heard her moaning as she shut the door behind her.
"Her name can't be Amy Persimmon, because she didn't stay on her own feet," whispered Jane to Michael. But Mr. Wig was looking at Mary Poppins, a curious look, half amused, half accusing.
"Mary, Mary, you shouldn't. Bless my soul, you shouldn't, Mary. The poor old body will never get over it. But, oh, my goodness, didn't she look funny waddling through the air? My gracious goodness, but didn't she?"
And he and Jane and Michael were off again, rolling about the air, clutching their sides and gasping with laughter at the thought of how funny Miss Persimmon had looked.
"Oh, dear," said Michael, "don't make me laugh any more. I can't stand it. I shall break."
"Oh, oh, oh," cried Jane as she gasped for breath with her hand over her heart.
"Oh, my gracious, glorious, glumping goodness," roared Mr. Wig, dabbing his eyes with his coat tail because he couldn't find his handkerchief. "It is time to go home." Mary Poppins's voice sounded above the roars of laughter like a trumpet. And suddenly, with a rush, Jane and Michael and Mr. Wig came down. They landed on the floor with a huge bump altogether. The thought that they would have to go home was the first sad thought of the afternoon, and the moment it was in their minds, the laughing gas went out of them. Jane and Michael sighed as they watched Mary Poppins come slowly down the air carrying Jane's coat and hat. Mr. Wig sighed too, a great long, heavy sigh.
"Well, isn't that a pity?" he said soberly. "It's very sad that you've got to go home.
I never enjoyed an afternoon so much. Did you?
Never, said Michael sadly, feeling how dull it was to be down on the earth again with no laughing gas inside him. Never, never, said Jane, as she stood on tiptoe and kissed Mr. Wigg's withered apple cheeks. Never, 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 never. They sat on either side of Mary Poppins going home in the bus. They were both very quiet, thinking over the lovely afternoon. Presently, Michael said sleepily to Mary Poppins, "How often does your uncle get like that?"
"Like what?" said Mary Poppins sharply, as though Michael had deliberately said something to offend her.
"Well, all bouncy and boundy and laughing and going up in the air."
"Up in the air?"
Mary Poppins' voice was high and angry.
"What do you mean, pray, up in the air?"
Jane tried to explain. "Michael means, is your uncle often full of laughing gas, and does he often go rolling and bobbing about on the ceiling when—"
"Rolling and bobbing? What an idea! Rolling and bobbing on the ceiling! You'll be telling me next he's a balloon!"
Mary Poppins gave an offended sniff.
"But he did," said Michael. "We saw him." "What, Roland Bob? How dare you? I'll have you know that my uncle is a sober, honest, hard-working man, and you'll be kind enough to speak of him respectfully, and don't bite your bus ticket. Roland Bob, indeed. The idea!"
Michael and Jane looked across Mary Poppins at each other. They said nothing, for they had learnt that it was better not to argue with Mary Poppins, no matter how odd anything seemed. But the look that passed between them said, "Is it true, or isn't it, about Mr. Wigg? Is Mary Poppins right, or are we?" But there was nobody to give them the right answer. The bus roared on, wildly lurching and bounding. Mary Poppins sat between them, offended and silent, and presently, because they were very tired, they crept closer to her and leant up against her sides and fell asleep, still wondering. Chapter 4 Miss Lark's Andrew. Miss Lark lived next door. But before we go any further, I must tell you what next door looked like. It was a very grand house, by far the grandest in Cherry Tree Lane. Even Admiral Boom had been known to envy Miss Lark her wonderful house, though his own had ship's funnels instead of chimneys and a flagstaff in the front garden. Over and over again, the inhabitants of the lane heard him say as he rolled past Miss Lark's mansion,
"Blast me, gizzard! What does she want with a house like that?"
And the reason of Admiral Boom's jealousy was that Miss Lark had two gates. One was for Miss Lark's friends and relations, and the other for the butcher and the baker and the milkman. Once the baker made a mistake and came in through the gate reserved for the friends and relations, and Miss Lark was so angry that she said she wouldn't have any more bread ever. But in the end, she had to forgive the baker because he was the only one in the neighbourhood who made those little flat rolls with the curly twists of crust on the top. She never really liked him very much after that, however, and when he came, he pulled his hat far down over his eyes so that Miss Lark might think he was somebody else. But she never did. Jane and Michael always knew when Miss Lark was in the garden or coming along the lane, because she wore so many brooches and necklaces and earrings that she jingled and jangled just like a brass band. And whenever she met them, she always said the same thing. "Good morning," or "Good afternoon," if it happened to be after luncheon, "and how are we today?" And Jane and Michael were never quite sure whether Miss Lark was asking how they were or how she and Andrew were. So they just replied, "Good afternoon," or of course, "Good morning," if it was before luncheon. All day long, no matter where the children were, they could hear Miss Lark calling in a very loud voice things like, "Andrew, where are you?" or "Andrew, you mustn't go out without your overcoat," or "Andrew, come to Mother." And if you didn't know, you would think that Andrew must be a little boy. Indeed, Jane thought that Miss Lark thought that Andrew was a little boy. But Andrew wasn't. He was a dog, one of those small, silky, fluffy dogs that look like a fur necklet until they begin to bark. But, of course, when they do that, you know that they're dogs. No fur necklet ever made a noise like that. Now, Andrew led such a luxurious life that you might have thought he was the Shah of Persia in disguise.
He slept on a silk pillow in Miss Lark's room. He went by car to the hairdresser's twice a week to be shampooed. He had cream for every meal and sometimes oysters, and he possessed 4 overcoats with checks and stripes in different colours. Andrew's ordinary days were filled with the kind of things most people have only on birthdays, and when Andrew himself had a birthday, he had 2 candles on his cake for every year instead of only 1. The effect of all this was to make Andrew very much disliked in the neighbourhood. People used to laugh heartily when they saw Andrew sitting up in the back seat of Miss Lark's car on the way to the hairdresser's with the fur rug over his knees and his best coat on. And on the day when Miss Lark bought him 2 pairs of small leather boots so that he could go out in the park wet or fine, everybody in the lane came down to their front gates to watch him go by and to smile secretly behind their hands. "Pooh," said Michael, as they were watching Andrew one day through the fence that separated number 17 from next door. "Pooh, he's a ninky-poop."
"How do you know?" asked Jane, very interested.
"I know because I heard Daddy call him one this morning," said Michael, and he laughed at Andrew very rudely.
"He is not a nincompoop," said Mary Poppins, "and that is that."
And Mary Poppins was right. Andrew wasn't a nincompoop, as you will very soon see. You must not think he did not respect Miss Lark. He did. He was even fond of her in a mild sort of way. He couldn't help having a kindly feeling for somebody who had been so good to him ever since he was a puppy, even if she did kiss him rather too often. But there was no doubt about it that the life Andrew led bored him to distraction. He would have given half his fortune, if he had one, for a nice piece of raw red meat, instead of the usual breast of chicken or scrambled eggs with asparagus. For in his secret innermost heart, Andrew longed to be a common dog. He never passed his pedigree, which hung on the wall in Miss Lark's drawing-room, without a shudder of shame, and many a time he wished he'd never had a father, nor a grandfather, nor a great-grandfather, if Miss Lark was going to make such a fuss of it. It was this desire of his to be a common dog that made Andrew choose common dogs for his friends, and whenever he got the chance, he would run down to the front gate and sit there watching for them, so that he could exchange a few common remarks. But Miss Lark, when she discovered him, would be sure to call out, "Andrew, Andrew, come in, my darling. Come away from those dreadful street Arabs." And of course, Andrew would have to come in, or Miss Lark would shame him by coming out and bringing him in. And Andrew would blush and hurry up the steps so that his friends should not hear her calling him her precious, her joy, her little lump of sugar. Andrew's most